Climate change is no longer something for 2050 and all we've got to do is just reduce our carbon emissions and everything will be okay. I mean, what is very clear is that whatever we do with carbon emissions, we are facing a very challenging future environmentally for the next 10 or 20 years.
So I think we need to, as a scientific community, as an operational community, we have the great deal to guide a bit in Europe what should be the priorities.
So welcome to The Day Today, our continuing podcast on how we can understand the Earth's system and the Earth's environment using satellite data. Today I'm joined by Professor Dame Julia Slingo and Paolo Ruti. Welcome to both of you. Julia, you are a former chief scientist of the Met Office. And now, how do you describe your career now?
Well, officially I'm retired. But I do a range of advisory roles and consultancies and those sorts of things as and when something interesting comes up where I think I have something still to offer.
Which seems to be quite often. Paolo, you are UMetSat's chief scientist.
Yes.
So you've both are or have been chief scientists. So what does it mean to be a chief scientist in an environmental organisation or in a weather service? Julia?
Well, first of all, I should say it's an enormous privilege. And for me, I suppose it was the best job one could wish for in meteorology. Because you're able to influence the science that's done across all aspects, in my case, of weather forecasting from a few hours ahead to long-term climate change. And I had at my disposal over 500, really, some of them quite extraordinary scientists and all of them really good researchers and practitioners. So it was both a privilege, but also one has to say, of course, a huge responsibility. Mm. Because as Paolo will know, you know, what you decide to invest in for the future will determine how good the Met Office would be in delivering its mission, which at the end of the day is to save lives and livelihoods. And so it's not like academic research in that respect. You're very well aware that the path you set your research has big implications for the health of the organisation and the services it provides in the coming decade.
So the almost the shadow cast by the decisions you make is awfully long.
Yes, it is. And that's the role that you take on.
Yeah.
Of course, in my case, also, you were very much at the sharp end of the political debate on climate change. And that was at times quite challenging because I always feel, and I still do, that we have to be rock solid in our scientific evidence. Mm. Everything we say, we have to be able to back up by scientific evidence. And that, again, is a huge responsibility. And people will want you to say, give much more definitive answers. And sometimes the science will allow you to do. So it can be a very challenging place to be.
I'm loving how you smile as you say that. So, Paolo, I mean, we're a different organisation here at UMetSat, but how do you reflect on being a chief scientist today?
I would certainly agree with Julia, that is a great honor and responsibility at the same time. In UMetSat, which is an operational organization to deliver meteorological satellites, meteorological and climatological data, and not only environmental data as well to our user, I think the main role is to help the organization on scouting the horizons, scientific horizon, technological horizon, and to make sure to link this scouting to what is the evolution of user requirement. Mm-hmm. on the long term. So it's not user today, it's users in 10, 15 years, because this is the time scale where satellite they are planned or designed. So there is it's very intriguing, I would say, as a job. It's very interesting. And there's many dimensions that we hope to be able to support the organization. In this role, I would say one important aspect is also to be connected with the community, with a diverse community, because this is not one man show job. It's really a capacity to connect, to network.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess for both of you, the decisions you make for the what happens in the future, that diversity of perspective is even more important, because then that says, whose future are you serving, or what future are you serving?
That's right. And I think, you know, of course, you add into that dimension climate change, which I think is becoming really quite a massive issue for all of us, more rapidly than I think we kind of expected, I suppose. One can still debate the role of climate change in last summer's floods and this summer's heat and wildfires in Europe, but they do seem to be sort of fairly unprecedented. And so the pace of change, of the nature of the challenges that we face as forecasters and early warning systems, all of which depend absolutely crucially on the satellite observations, and the sorts of issues and questions people are now asking of us, I think are changing in nature and in perspective. Climate change is no longer something for 2050, and all we've got to do is just reduce our carbon emissions and everything will be okay. I mean, what is very clear is that climate change is with us now, and whatever we do with carbon emissions, we are facing a very challenging future environmentally for the next 10 or 20 years. And so that sort of has to change your perspective on what the science and technology priorities are, and what we need to be able to observe, and what we need to be able to predict to help people manage these increasingly difficult challenges from extreme weather, other environmental issues.
So we're going to talk a little bit today about sort of modelling and simulation and prediction. Are there any of those words that you modelling, simulation, prediction, do you like or don't like or are helpful?
Well, to be honest, I think that modelling is a difficult word. And the more I interact with non-specialists, now that I'm a retired meteorologists, and I start interacting with groups working on broader environmental issues and communication and impacts and all those sorts of things, it's very clear that to them a model is some sort of construct of based on data from using statistical approaches or AI or machine learning or whatever, those sorts of ideas. And it's very difficult, and they think that everything that you do is you've sort of hardwired the answer into your model, and it's been actually really, I think, a very unhelpful in the end word, because it has too many different connotations. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we start to talk about simulation, and actually that leads you on to then this concept of digital twins, which people do begin to understand a little bit. But when you talk about simulation, you can actually introduce the glories of the physical climate system and the fluid motions and all those things and their relationship with very fundamental physical equations, the immutable laws of physics, which define some sort of boundaries of what the Earth's climate system can do. So I think, you know, we're in a sense, I think simulation is a better word for what we do, but whether, I still don't know whether people grasp the important difference between those two. And then I think, you know, the idea of, well, I think prediction is probably a good catch-all now, which can cover everything from predicting the next few hours to predicting the evolution of our changing climate.
But it's really interesting listening to you think out loud about the words we use.
Yes.
Because you're trying to maintain a scientific precision.
Yes.
But drop the guardianship of science, make these ideas more broadly useful and accessible to people?
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, so one of the other things that always concerns me is we talk about our model errors, right?
Yes.
Common. Two words I don't like, they're model. And I definitely don't like the word errors.
Yes.
Errors implies that we've got something wrong. And actually, we may not necessarily have got something wrong. The model is only as good as our knowledge. And we know that the models are incomplete in their representation of the physics. So they have biases, but they're as right as they can be for the way that we, for the knowledge that we have about all the complex processes that go on in our climate system. And they're incomplete from the point of view of our ability computationally to represent the fundamental physics that we know is at the core of the climate system. So I'm very, very unhappy with the word errors.
Model and error.
I would like, I mean, uncertainty is better because it reflects the true case that our knowledge is incomplete.
Yeah, the scientific community is always looking to anomalies on our capacity to detect or understand the physical nature. So if you are looking to discern the particle physics, is actually they are specifically looking to deviation from their standard model to say, okay, we can discover something new. There's new space for understanding the intimate nature of what is made the universe or our Earth. And this is the kind of approach, I agree with Julia, it's a subtle language definition, but I think we need to work on the uncertainty of our world, and how we communicate this uncertainty to the users is another tricky area where I think a lot meteorologists a lot of work.
That's right, and of course, you know, this is uncertainty requires us not only to sort of work with our models and communicate, but it also, of course, puts a requirement on the observations as well.
Yes, very much.
And I think this is, you know, this incomplete nature of our incomplete knowledge. I mean, having been in the subject for nearly 50 years, I can still remember the first time I really saw a satellite image that was exciting. And, you know, I was plotting sort of basic observations from radio sons, you know, in my early days of trying to understand why clouds form and where they form. And, you know, we have come an immense distance in the last few decades, not least because we were able to view in greater and greater detail what's happening in the atmosphere and the land surface, particularly and the upper ocean from satellites. And so I think, you know, it's the fusion of theory, observations and simulation, which is at the heart of everything we do. And theory actually underpins not just the simulations, but also the observations and at what scale we think we need to observe things and with what complexity. And I think that's a really very interesting debate that just goes on as our knowledge increases, actually.
So a very broad question. Where are we at today? What's the current state of the art with respect to observation and simulation? And we'll get on to talk about the digital twins in a moment.
Yes, well, I think you have to sort of split it up, don't you, in terms of observations and simulation for operational weather prediction, numerical weather prediction. And of course, we know we have come a massively long way on that. And UMETSAT has played an absolutely vital role in that. So the operational weather satellites have been at the core of the enormous advances in forecasting skill. It's extraordinary, in fact. Mm. I mean, I just look at 2 weeks ago, when the Met Office, several days before the event, put out a red alert, the first time ever for heat.
Yeah.
It was a very, in my view, a very bold forecast because they were quite specific about the location. And a red alert triggers all the emergency services, it closes all sorts of things. I mean, this is something you do very, very rarely. And, you know, people were advised to stay at home, etc. Now, that to me was quite an extraordinary and bold forecast. But it couldn't have been done, of course, without the extraordinary model. Well, I'm going to call them models, simulations or forecasts that were made with these extraordinary models now, that are able to, of course, assimilate the observations so much more successfully. So there's two sides to this story. There's this enormous advance in satellite technology and satellite platforms, allied to extraordinary advances in the capability of the models to assimilate these data, these observations, and make sense of them in a four-dimensional manner. And the two go hand in hand, and they also go hand in hand, of course, with computer technology, which has enabled all of this to happen. And you can't have just one of those. You have to have the full basket. And I think, and the models have also, the forecasts and the models have also allowed us to evaluate where the greatest benefit to the forecasts comes from a particular observation type. And so when, you know, UMetSat is thinking about what are our priorities for the future, then the impact of a specific observation on a forecast is part of that really essential information that you need. Now, that's where the forecasting, and then, you know, of course, we need to come on to climate monitoring and the degrees that is important.
If I can, Julia, there's an aspect that I think it's also important, as taking as an example these last 2 weeks or maybe even more of drought coming from the Mediterranean side. There is another word that is, of course, integration and Earth system approach. If you're looking to what's happening in Italy, so there's several months of drought. And if you're looking to the Po River, which is a big integrator of all, everything is happening on a large, on a mesoscale or large scale, you have the usually you have fresh water going to the to the ocean, while in extreme situation you have salty water penetrating back into the river estuaries and coming in the interior. In 2003 it reached 30 kilometers. Today in Italy it reached 40 kilometers. So there is a question on how we answer this integration between meteorology, climate, and hydrology, as an example here, and this capacity to integrate observations and the simulations. And I think this is the one of the frontier where of course we need to work in this user perspective, because user, they are not asking you, they're asking you to predict this type of extreme events with those type of phenomena that are absolutely dramatically impacting agriculture and the life of people.
Yeah, because that salty water coming up and not being washed away by the sweet or the fresh water, it has a dramatic effect on what you can grow. We were talking with colleagues earlier on this week about, and they were quite worried about what's happening there.
So the climate, as Julia was rightly pointing out, is also changing the perspective of how we develop user requirement in the future, because it's tremendously impacting of the type of weather event today we experience and what type of weather event we will experience in 15, 20 years.
So we've gotten quite good at warning people maybe 5 days out of a significant weather event. And the we, I mean, is those of us who are involved in producing the simulations, in producing the satellite data, and also the weather services, who are the ones who are actually issuing the official warnings and making those statements. What are some of the things that we can't quite do right now that we need to be able to do much better in the future? So you're getting towards the Earth system side. Are there any other areas that we need to be better at as we get into the future?
Well, actually, I think, you know, Paolo has just given a fantastic example of something happening actually on quite a short timescale that a fully coupled, if you like, response to a meteorological event, the drought, it's meteorologically driven. The environment is fully coupled, and there you see a combination of river catchment response with tidal and penetration of seawater up the estuary and so forth. And the more and more you look at some of even the short-term impacts, you realise that to really be able to warn people of the impacts, you need to take a much more, if you like, call it an earth system, if you like. I tend to call it an environmental system problem at the fine scale over the coming week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, as depending on the nature of the hazard. And the more we look at this, we see more and more there's a combination of different systems, whether they're hydrological, meteorological, soil systems, agricultural systems. The coastal ocean is hugely important, and in this country, tides are hugely important, and storm surges are hugely important for delivering the impact of a specific weather event. And so, you know, we started actually when I was coming to the end of my time as chief scientist, I initiated a whole program called UK Environmental Prediction, which was an attempt to couple our river and hydrology, land hydrology model, with our atmosphere, with our coastal ocean, with our tides, and the river outflows and everything, so that we could get a really integrated view of what was happening to our local environment, not just in extreme events, but more generally. And I do actually think, and that they've made great progress with that, actually, and I do think that we need more and more on all timescales to take this more holistic view of the environment and the role that weather plays in, and then other systems in delivering the impact, not just to us human beings and our infrastructure, but actually also to the natural world.
I've been resisting introducing two new words into the conversation, because I think you've both been describing the thing that matters really rather beautifully. And it's this idea of the digital twins. So the idea of having an enhanced observation and simulation capability. So within the European Union, that's the Destination Earth Initiative, which seeks to really provide new capabilities in the direction that you are describing. Would you like to introduce the concept of digital twins?
Before giving a definition, I would say we need to look at the drivers, why we are speaking about digital twins.
Yes.
I think there are certainly two drivers, one scientific, but also one user-oriented. So as we have, Julia was explaining, but as you can see, many other examples. So the type of information the user they want is intrinsically related to weather prediction or to climate prediction, but to many other factors or systems. So, I mean, another recent example, in some coastal region, because of the drought, there is the presence of Helicobacter, and they have to stop. That is a strong consequences for tourism. So for users, this is an important element, how you link something which is related to health to weather and climate and other parameters. So the driver to the digital twin, to me, one of the driver is a user-oriented driver. So you need to bring the science very close to what is needed. And then, of course, there is a scientific driver as well, because the community is advancing on the capacity and understanding of what is needed. That this is just a piece of the definition. So I back to Julia.
Well, of course, the first thing I'd say is that ever since we started simulating the atmosphere and the climate system and so forth, which is, you know, 50 years plus, we've been doing digital twins. We do digital twins every day of the atmosphere and the oceans. So in a way, it's another way of saying sort of simulation or modelling. But actually, there's, I think what is really behind this is finally this, again, the bringing together of our science, our environmental science, with socioeconomics. And so one can think in the context of, you know, cities are going to be a major place still where people live and do their business and so forth. And there are a lot of questions about how do you design a climate-proof city? And so, you know, a digital twin is a way of exploring the what-ifs, if you like, of a system, and it might be a closed system like a city, and it's, say, its transport system or its energy system or whatever, by looking at, you know, the options available to you in the future. And meteorology and weather and climate, of course, come into those, that information. And so ultimately, you really do want to actually have a digital twin, which combines the environmental science and issues and how the environment is going to change as the planet warms, alongside the sort of socioeconomic structures that we think might be around in the future. And I think this is a really, this is kind of a really exciting bit of science going forward. And it involves essentially its simulation, but of a holistic system, which includes us, which frankly, up to now, we kind of avoided, you know, we have trees and plants and things like that in our system, but we don't have human agents doing things to the natural environment except pumping out greenhouse gases and things like that and changing the landscape. You know, so this is where this is heading, and it's very visionary. And I think this is where you begin to ask some really pertinent questions about the relevance of the weather and climate prediction information and the relevance of the observations to underpin these digital twins of the future.
There's a risk, because we need to agree on the fact that nowadays it's became so, let's say, so fancy to use digital twin word, that we need to put on the table a bit the priorities. Otherwise, we will not be able to attain any of these with the given funds or investment we have. So I think we need to, as a scientific community, as an operational community, we have the great deal to guide a bit in Europe what should be the priorities, because that's when you enter this fantastic world where any kind of information would be available, which is not true.
So I think within the European Union work, the priority is sort of environmental extremes and within climate change, but they're still pretty big areas. So what would you choose as priorities?
It's very clear that if you look at most of our simulation systems, and particularly our global systems, and particularly our global climate system simulations, the representation of the future of rain, what our rainfall futures are going to look like, is really, really poor. Yeah. And we only have to look at these last two summers to know that rainfall, too much of it in the wrong place or too little of it, drives immense impacts. And yet we're in a situation, frankly, that our rainfall simulations at the global climate models, and that are used within the IPCC assessments, I would say that the biases in those have not changed for at least 20 years.
So that means the modelling improvement isn't there yet. That's the improvements of those estimates.
There's actually here the case that our knowledge based on observations and actually computational models used as laboratory tools, exploratory tools, not necessarily for forecasting, although more recently it's true in forecasting as well. Our knowledge has increased significantly. We now know that we can only simulate and therefore predict the future of our rainfall if we're modeling at the kilometre scale. Yeah. Now, that's a quantum leap from where we are currently in IPCC, which at best is 50 kilometres. Our global forecast models are now down at 10 kilometres, but even they will struggle with some of these systems, as we know. And we need to be at the kilometre scale. And we've lots and lots now of scientific evidence that shows that actually we must do this if we're going to talk about the future of our water. Yeah.
Because I guess so. What would that look like in the IPCC reports? These are the big climate change reports. They're very, very careful about the language they use around when something will happen. You know, how certain is it that a thing will happen? And what we'll see is more certainty in those descriptions of our rainfall future with this kind of modelling.
It's actually much more fundamental than that, and it goes back to the roots of what drives the global weather and climate system. And we call something in the warm pool region of the planet, I know this is getting technical, but I think this is a very fundamental point. And it's one that I've worked on all my career because I've worked in tropical climate and weather. The Indonesian, West Pacific Indian Ocean region, we call it the warm pool. It's where the warmest ocean on the planet sits.
Yeah.
And where you get active convection, rainfall production, a lot of the time, all the time. And we call it the boiler house or the engine room of the global circulation. And the fact of the matter, and what's going on in that region perturbs and drives the structure of the jet stream that affects our weather. And what we've known for a very long time is that our ability to represent that engine room, boiler house, is not good. It's inadequate in many respects. And my suspicion is that if we don't get that fundamental bit of the climate system right, we've compromised the vagaries of the jet stream, the sort of waves we see now that have been causing us these blocks that have led to the terrible drought this year in Europe, southern Europe. And etc. And we also know that these models are incapable of even dealing with modes of natural variability such as El Nino.
So this is the first step of chief scientist thinking. What is the challenge that we face and why does it matter? So what's the next step in your chief scientist thinking?
Well, you know, we have to get, first of all, as a key point here, is that we have not been scrupulously honest about this. This is a major deficiency in the ability of our global models, and it has ramifications to all aspects of natural variability and impacts of climate change and weather regimes where we live and across the world. It also potentially has impacts on climate sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I may be wrong, but actually my gut feeling is that there will be something different if we model at this scale. So this is where I've come to, and I don't think that we have any way through this except to resolve and represent as fully as possible the physics of these, we call them mesoscale convective systems, organized storms.
Yep.
And that requires, and we know this now from quite a lot of research over the last decade or so, that this requires a model that is run at the kilometre scale. Now, that is not for the faint-hearted.
And this is, I think, one of the aspirations within the European Union Destination Earth is to get down to 500 metres.
Kilometre scale. I mean, and Destination Earth is saying the same thing. But actually, what do you need in terms of infrastructure and technology to do that? You need the equivalent of CERN. You need dedicated exascale, state-of-the-art machine, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where international collaboration, like you have in UMETSAT, is fundamental. If we're going to do the big science that the world demands of us to be able to talk about what's going to happen to our climate, we can make a really strong case, science case, to do it. And then, you know, you've got the bedrock on which Destination Earth and digital twins can be built. I mean,
And then do something special and important.
What does it mean for you, Metsat? I mean, already now we know that we have a massive capacity to measure, to observe. Rainfall is one example, but the water cycle. So you have a capacity with microwave measurement, as an example, to look at the humidity into the atmosphere. You have the capacity to have a resolution. We will launch at the end of this year, we will launch our Meteosat third generation with the capacity to look at cloud at 500 meter scale. No, we know this. We have this on our hands. At the same time, we know that a lot amount of this data is not perfectly used by the models. So most of the data, actually, they are not used. Only some of those, they are entering what is called the data simulation system, etc. So there is a fundamental question for EUMETSAT and all the other research or operational institution, the meteorological services and ECNWF, on how we ensure the right proper effort to work towards a 1 kilometer scale capable to make the maximum use of our data. And there's another question that, of course, is extremely important, because what Julia was mentioning in terms of the intimate nature of the global circulation of the atmosphere, which is this beautiful engine that nature created for us into the Earth. I think there's details of that engine, like what is called the inverse cascade of energy, which brings information from small scales up to the one of the most known instability, which usually we see as a storm, which is called baroclinic instability, but is a storm for most of the people. And this upscale of energy cascade, it's taking information from the small scales, bringing to the larger scale, which means that you are reducing a bit the capacity to predict. So we need to inject in that part of the system a lot of information if we want to keep the system, our capacity to predict the system. So this is, for EUMETSAT point of view, at the end, as a scientific question, this is the ultimate scientific question for EUMETSAT, because that will open the door to bring more data to the meteorological and climatological big CERN, as Julia was mentioning. So this is our road, let's say, is back rock we need to work on.
Yeah, so squeezing everything out of today's data, but also making sure that tomorrow's observations are the right ones to address the grand challenge that Julia describes.
One aspect, which is the socio-economic aspect that Julia was alluding to, is extremely important. I think EUMETSAT is used to work with the assumption to bring to the table the right socio-economic benefit figure for the future satellite, because of course we are asking our member states, so countries, we are asking a significant amount of contribution for the future satellites, and we need all the time to demonstrate what is the usual revenue in terms of benefit to society. And using the most conservative approach, so looking to a few hazards such as flooding or big storms, we always reach a kind of magic number, which is 1 to 7 in most of the cases. And this is one example, but socioeconomic means many, many other. So there are other directions. Of course, we don't consider saving one single life is so, cannot attach any number to a life. So we don't consider this, but we just consider the goods and already we reach this very good ratio. And I think this is important for all endeavors. So that's probably is one of the challenges that this type of endeavor that Julia was mentioning bring to the table, a very good analysis of the social economic benefit.
Because that generates international and national government energy and momentum. That generates movement, that generates instruction to organisations like ours of get this done.
As Paolo says, it's actually very easy to justify the costs from the socioeconomic benefits for today. I think, you know, we're really talking about how do we future-proof the future, future-proof the ourselves to the future climate.
Yeah.
And that's... you can easily come up with some enormous numbers when you start thinking about that. And we could look at the Po, for example, and whether some sort of management of the estuary, for example. I don't know. And in London, it's the Thames Barrier. You know, you're talking huge amounts of money. But we need to know, I think, what the worst case scenario could be, realistically, what the worst case scenario could be. And nobody anticipated the severity of the floods in Liguria last summer and the temperatures and wildfires over Europe and the drought in the Po this summer. I mean, it's just extraordinary temperatures we've seen.
Yeah, truly, truly unusual. We have to draw to a close. So I would invite you both to offer some encouragement to somebody who is at their early career in our world or maybe thinking about a career in the Earth system or the environmental system world, to the contributions that they might be making, now and in the future.
I'm retired now, and I wish I was 50 years younger, because I think there's a golden opportunity to do some amazing science. With that combination of the details we can now get from observations, particularly from space, allied with the ability to simulate the Earth system, I think there's some fantastic breakthrough science to be done. I also think that this is the moment we have to step up and serve the world, really serve the world, because... we've done it in my field, I think, admirably in the development of weather forecasting for weather. But I think we now know with, the huge challenges we've got in sustainability and growing populations and all those issues, that much more is needed from us. And I think that's a really exciting prospect where we can start to bring in much more interdisciplinary science, that whatever your science interest is for a young person, whether it's in fundamental physics or whether it's in human justice and climate, there's a range of problems here now that we need this multifaceted perspective on what we want to achieve. So it's a hugely exciting time for young people to engaging in interdisciplinary science and interdisciplinary solutions. So, as I say, I wish I was 50 years younger.
I saw some of that excitement. There was the European Space Agency Living Planet Conference a couple of months, and some of that interdisciplinary excitement and joy and people really working across boundaries was very visible, and it was really exciting to see it. Paolo?
So I think... I absolutely echo what Giulia said for the young generation. I think this is putting on us a bit of additional responsibility because we need to make sure to bring them soon close to the decision-making level. I think this is a problem typically in our organizations. We need to open the door to young people to interact more on the decision-making level. And this is to me our responsibility to make sure that for what Giulia was proposing, I think we need to make sure that those doors are open.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you both for a very enriching conversation. It is challenging. It leaves the challenge on the table, and it is there for us to address now. Thank you very, very much indeed to both of you.